It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Nearly 2 months ago, Earth was visited by two asteroids, one expected and one not expected. Scientists had been following a flying meteor that was supposed to come within 17,000 miles of Earth. They worried that it might come close enough to hit or disrupt some satellites, but that one came and passed without any serious trouble. But then, in the early morning of February 15th, a second asteroid, one most scientists didn't predict, flew by much closer, over Russia. This one created an incredible light show across the sky, followed by an enormous explosion as the asteroid approached Earth's atmosphere and blew apart, creating a blast equal to 400 kilotons of dynamite. But these asteroids aren't the only flying visitors looking to impress us this year. 2013 is being called the Year of the Comet, with three of them gracing our skies. One has already passed, one you'll be able to see with a telescope in May, and one that astronomers are really excited about, called a sun grazer, we may even be able to see in the daylight at the end of this year. Today in the Exchange, an astronomy update, and let's hear from you this hour. What questions do you have for our sky guys about comets and asteroids, the search for possible life on Mars, or the complexities of a space trip to the red planet, which, by the way, is now being planned by a private company? The Exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our sky guys are John Gianforte, co-founder of the Astronomical Society of Northern New England and an astronomy instructor for Granite State College and UNH. His website is theskyguide.org. And John, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Also with us, Mal Cameron, former astronomy and space educator at the McAuliffe Shepard Discovery Center. And Mal, welcome back. Good to see you, too.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, and guys, let's talk about this mega meteor, it's being called, that exploded over Russia. It's been almost 2 months since it exploded, fortunately, over a rural area. Mal, what have we learned since that time about this thing? It was pretty amazing.
Well, yeah, it was. In fact, they were comparing it to an earlier one back in 1908, called the Tunguska meteor, that I guess was a little bit bigger than this one, but it still carried quite a wallop. It leveled a whole bunch of trees and stuff, happened to hit in a remote area in Russia. Nobody knew what it was at the time, but this one was interesting because it actually came close to a big city. Fortunately, it shattered windows, broke buildings, and that sort of thing from the shockwave, but the surprise was there was everybody tracking another meteor that was coming, or asteroid, that was floating past Earth. And they expected that one, but this one came from a different direction, totally unexpected. And I think that's what has people worried, that this can happen. But it's like, John, you can correct me on this too, but it's like once every 100, 200 years or so, something like this can be expected to happen, I think. But yes, it came down. They saw it. There were a lot of videos on it from cell phones. Interesting, in Russia, they have a lot of problems with crime. So one of the big sellers is they have these car video gizmos that take constant videos.
So like surveillance cameras.
Like surveillance cameras.
Also probably from the former Soviet state. You know, they were always sort of
watching
their people.
Sure. There's a lot of underhanded stuff going on. So they need proof, and they sell these things for security things. So if they have an accident or something, they can see what's going on. But all of these cameras were going from various commuters and so on, and captured videos of all different directions of this object coming down through space, looked like a fireball. And I'm sure it was probably darn scary. They didn't know. I think the first thing we think, because of the culture these days, is if you saw something big and fiery coming toward you, you're probably going to think it's somebody attacking you.
Sure, you'd think it was a bomb or something.
Right. But this is certainly, it wasn't. It turned out to be this big rock from space that slammed into the atmosphere at thousands of miles an hour, tens of thousands of miles an hour. And what that does is, just like a typical meteor shower of sorts, it slams into the atmosphere, compresses the air in front of it so much because of its heavy speed that it shatters the rock apart, it explodes, And this compression of air that it's directing in front of it blows apart anything in its path. Now, what kind of saved this from a lot of damage is it was coming in at an angle and not straight down from the sky. If it had done that, it would have leveled a lot more area and been a lot more devastating than it had been.
Yeah, there's some great stories about one teacher in an elementary school who had all her kids do like a duck and cover under the desks, and that was great because the windows shattered, but nobody got hurt. But clarify something, too, and Mal, you touched on this, but John, just a little more. This thing didn't really land. It's not like an asteroid slammed into the Earth. That's not correct.
That's right. There were pieces. This exploded between 20 and 30 kilometers above the ground. Just like the Tunguska event that Mal spoke about in 1908. So you have two occurrences over Russia within, you know, about 100 years of each other, and 100 meter across body is estimated to fall on, you know, into the atmosphere once every approximately 100 years. But it didn't. There was an explosion because of the shockwave that Mal talked about. And so high up, this airburst, if you will, is what did all the damage. There were pieces, though, that did make it to the surface, and some of them have been recovered. There have been a lot of phony pieces found and put on eBay. But
it's human nature, isn't it?
Yes. If you can make a buck, I mean, why not?
Yeah. And it left a big crater, right, John?
It broke through the ice in a lake, and they were trying to retrieve that piece. So you can imagine that, you know, something that big, you know, 50 meters across, blows up, some pieces are going to fall, not very fast. It would hurt you if you got hit by those, but some pieces did make it to the ground, and we'll be able to tell a lot more once those are found, you know, retrieved and analyzed and papers written on them, and we can find out exactly. We'll even be able to tell what asteroid this piece came from, more than likely, in some period of time.
Well, there's a couple interesting elements for me about this story, and we've talked about them. I mean, one is it's so unusual. It's so big. It only happens once every 100 years. The other is what Mal mentioned. We've got great footage of it now because of all the cameras that we have. But pick up, John, if you could, please, on the other piece that Mal mentioned. Everybody been looking toward another asteroid, and they weren't expecting this one.
Right. That's exactly right. We were expecting the close flyby of another asteroid that was about three times bigger in size that was supposed to occur later in the day, in the afternoon, Eastern time.
Oh, on that same day?
On the same day, yeah. The Russia was in the early morning hours for them, not like 9 o'clock in the morning Russia time. The asteroid that was known about, that was called 2012 DA14 was the romantic name given that asteroid. That was due to pass in the mid-afternoon here, about 2:30, I think, something like that. Like you said, about 17,000 miles off the surface, which is in between the surface of the Earth and geosynchronous satellites. And that was known about. The one that exploded over Russia was unknown. And I got a lot of questions. Well, why didn't we know about this one? Why we should know about all of these? And that's probably the one thing that we could say we've benefited from. It's raised the awareness that impacts have been a part of our solar system since it formed 4.6 billion years ago. Take one look at the moon or the satellites of any of the other planets and many of the other planets themselves. They're littered with craters.
Okay, this may be the dumbest question ever, but I'm going to ask it anyway. On the same day, Mal, is it because these two asteroids are part of the same, even bigger asteroid, or is that just total crazy coincidence?
Well, think of how many asteroids are out there. There's a lot of them floating around. We think of asteroids being—I used to think asteroids, oh, they're in the asteroid belt.
Right.
Somewhere between Mars, but there are others that are closer to us. And a lot of them do cross the orbital path of the Earth. And so every now and then, we get really lucky in a sort.
So it's coincidence.
We get this about 50,000 years ago, there was an asteroid or a big rock that came down pretty much directly from above out in the United States. In Arizona, there is a place called Barringer Crater, or we nickname it Meteor Crater, which is almost a mile across, something like 3/4 of a mile across. And it was caused about 50,000 years ago. It's probably the best preserved crater from that we have on Earth that we can study. There are other craters that we've seen from satellite imagery that show outlines of craters that have since filled in with other things. So we know that Earth does get battered on a pretty regular basis. Going back to Tunguska, it was pointed out that when that in 1908, had that meteor or that object been like an hour later, it could have devastated Moscow.
Wow, just because of the position
because
of the Earth
of the
at that
Earth's turning underneath it, the Earth rotating. It was just about an hour away. It came in at the right time so that the Earth had was in front of this object coming towards it. So it happened to hit a remote area. And in this case of the one that in that city that I can't ever pronounce, it hit outside enough of the city, so we got building damage. But to my knowledge, I don't think anybody really got killed from it.
Right. No, I have not seen anything
like that. No injuries
that
way.
Yeah. Wow. So pretty close for comfort, especially for folks who live in Moscow. You know, you mentioned, and Mal did too, John, what we pull out of this. And as both of you said, it tells us that Earth gets battered on a regular basis. What else does this suggest to you, these big asteroids coming by pretty close?
Well, it means that we need to learn more about small orbiting bodies in the solar system. Every day, the Earth gains 1,000 tons of infalling material from space. Now, the Earth is big, so it's spread over a wide area. Most of them are micrometeors, so they're very small. They float to the Earth's surface. But bigger ones occur more rarely, but those are the ones that attract a lot of attention. So there's over 200 impact craters on the planet Earth that we know about. And the Barringer meteor crater in Arizona is a very well-preserved one that you can fly over and say, hey, that looks like a crater on the moon. So impacts are common, and they've shaped our solar system since it formed.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. Cool stuff, guys. And if you want to call about this mega meteor, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. A lot more conversation and your calls coming up.
This is NHPR. It's 9:19. Good morning. More of our astronomy update coming up on The Exchange, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show, states and the debate over abortion rights. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from FCI Federal, dedicated people working together to accomplish rewarding outcomes. That is the hallmark of FCI Federal. More information online at fcifederal.com. From the Shaheen and Gordon Law Firm, business and corporate law, health care, family matters, criminal defense, and personal injury. Offices in Dover, Concord, Manchester. ShaheenGordon.com. And Systems Plus Computers, providing Apple computers, iPads, ThinkPads, PC software, plus setup and accessories, with locations in Hanover and Lebanon, and at SystemsPlus.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, an update on the many recent discoveries in outer space. Our sky guys are here. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. What questions do you have for the sky guys about the year of the comet that we're going to talk about in just a minute, or Russia's mega asteroid that caused such a shock earlier this year? Later on, we'll also talk about the search for possible life on Mars and the planning for a human trip to the red planet, which is underway right now. Give us a call on these topics if you'd like to discuss them with our sky guys. We welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And Mal Cameron, John Gian Forty, let's go to the calls now. And Tom's calling in from Brentwood. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
My question is, do the Russians and or the Americans have enough firepower to knock one of these asteroids off course if it was headed for a major city? That's my first question. I have a two-part question.
Yeah, go ahead. Why don't you, sounds like your phone's breaking up, so why don't you ask that other one, Tom, and then we'll handle both of those. Go ahead.
And the other one is, what would that firepower need to be? You know, how many missiles or megatons of whatever weapon would we need to knock one of these things off course?
Yeah, it's a great question, Tom, and probably the subject, John Gene Forty, of several sci-fi movies from Hollywood. But it is a great question. What if one of these giant asteroids was heading toward, you know, Concord, New Hampshire, or New York City, or whatever? Do we have enough firepower to break it up, as our caller says?
Well, we probably more than firepower, we need intellectual power, because sending a big bomb or nuclear weapon to an asteroid that's en route to Earth probably isn't the best idea, because if it's big, you're only going to make it mad. You know, you're going to break off big chunks. You're still going to have a big piece basically on the same trajectory. Now you're going to have another little piece or a whole bunch of little pieces. So probably one of the things, the best defense against incoming asteroids is to learn of their presence years ahead of time. If we knew today that 20 years from now there's going to be a half a mile across asteroid that could impact the Earth, in 20 or 30 years, we could employ technology that we probably already have to make a very, very small change in the course of the asteroid now, so it misses Earth altogether.
Sending something way out disrupt it instead of when it's, you know, close.
Well, you have to be careful, because it all depends on the velocity, the trajectory, what the asteroid is made out of. So it could be as simple as, and I tell this to my students all the time, it could be as simple as painting the asteroid black.
Painting it?
Changing the albedo or reflectivity of an asteroid with a long enough notice can actually change a very small amount the trajectory of this of the asteroid. So if you have enough notice, you don't even have to blow up the asteroid, which I think would probably be a bad idea. So changing the reflectivity of an asteroid as it travels around the sun and as it rotates can change, because it's called the Yarkovsky effect. When an object is has a big difference in reflectivity, one side versus the other, it radiates energy that it gains on the day side. It radiates that at night on the asteroid, and that actually can give the asteroid a small amount of thrust. So if you can actually get to know the personal details of an asteroid that is inbound, say in 20 or 30 years, you can say, okay, this asteroid is so many kilometers in diameter, its mass is so many kilograms, this is the trajectory, we only have to deflect it, you know, 1/1000th of a degree, which is a very small amount. That can be done in other ways other than blowing it up.
Wow. Well, Tom, it's a great question and a fascinating answer. Some simple paint. Think of the jobs you could create at Benjamin Moore or Sherwin Williams or something. I'm just kidding. I'm sure the paint would be a little different from that.
Yes.
Tom, thank you very much for the question. Let's take another one. This is Earl in Lebanon. Hi, Earl. Go ahead. You're on the Exchange with the Sky Guys. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to go back to the question about two asteroids on the same day.
Right.
To me, that when you have two unusual events happening of a similar nature at the same time, there's very likely a connection. And it seemed, I wanted to know, were these two asteroids part of a group that was traveling together or what?
Yeah, no, Earl, it's a great point. And we talked about that a tiny bit, but I'm glad he asked it again, because it does seem, to the uninitiated, you know, too weird to be not connected.
Yeah, Earl, just an answer to that. It turns out that the one we were tracking, we knew where it was coming from, but this one that went over Russia was kind of a backdoor meteor. It came from a totally different direction. It was definitely not in any group or part of the one that we were tracking as it was going past. Of course, we were all breathed a big sigh of relief when it did go by, and we said, oh, we expected that. Yep, there it goes. Now we're safe. And then blam.
So it came from a different direction.
A whole different direction. And totally unexpected. It was actually smaller than the one we were tracking. And this is the problem, as John was saying, that we don't know a lot about these meteors. They are tracking many of them, but this one really was a surprise. And so what really we should put our money into, and I agree with John, is let's beef up the way of detecting these objects out there, or at least smaller ones, so that we can find out where they're coming from. We do know of another one that's being coming our way. It's been getting a lot of hype, called Apophis, or Pothos. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
And it's coming in 2029, and I believe it's April the 13th, which happens to be a Friday.
Of course.
Of course. And it's going to make a very, very, again, very close pass by. It's going to come into the area closer than the weather satellites that are out there and pass the Earth. But if it doesn't come in at the direct route that it says it's going to, if it comes just a little lower than they expect, the Earth's gravity can actually affect the orbital path of that Apophis, and 7 years later, it can come back and hit us.
Oh, dear.
So just something to think about.
Yeah.
But it won't happen this weekend.
All right, let's take another call. Earl, thank you for that question. And Ricky's calling from Hooksett. Hi, Ricky. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. Love your show, guys.
Good. Go ahead, Ricky.
Thanks. I just wanted to ask, how much do you have an estimation of how much usable information is burned or blown away from an asteroid by it entering our atmosphere? And if we could intercept it before it enters our atmosphere, like, how much more information do you think we could get off these things?
Wow, Ricky, that is a great question. John?
Well, the more observations you have of an asteroid or a comet, anything that's in orbit around the sun, the better able you are to predict its orbit long into the future. Now, asteroids are a little bit easier to calculate orbits for, but the more observations we have, the better. When an asteroid enters the Earth's atmosphere, only the very, very top superficial layers are burned up, depending on the size and mass of the asteroid. So a big one that's 50 feet or 150 feet across, like the two we were talking about in February, they basically, the one over Russia blew up, and the other one was three times bigger. That would have been a pretty devastating impact for that region of the planet that it hit. So in terms of information, we can get a lot of information just by making observations with visible light telescopes and radio telescopes in terms of its size, rotational rate, and mass.
Well, and Ricky, I want to let you know that other people are also interested in this, a lot of other people. This is just from space.com, just came out on Friday. It says NASA will likely get $100 million next year to jumpstart an audacious program to drag an asteroid into orbit around the moon for research and exploration purposes. This is from U.S. Senator Bill Nelson of Florida. So obviously he's got an interest there, Florida being the space coast. Nelson says the money is intended to get the ball rolling on the Asteroid Retrieval Project, which aims to send astronauts out to the captured space rock in 2021, and Nelson talks about it's both for mining the asteroid for precious minerals and also looking at developing ways to deflect one. So that's to your point, Ricky. So there is some thought going into that right now. Thanks for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And John, 2013, the year of the comet. That's what scientists are calling it. How come?
Well, because there's three bright comets that we know of. Comets can be discovered at any time. At any one day or any one night, there's more than two dozen comets that are up in the sky. Most of them never make the headlines because they're pretty faint and pretty small, and we don't really know about them. But astronomers do. This year, there are at least three bright comets that will make their way past the Earth and give people a good show. Not all people on the planet will see the comets in the same way. It seems that this year the comets are viewed best by folks in the southern hemisphere. That's been the case so far. Two comets presently in our skies, Comet Lemon, named after its discoverer, Comet Lemon was discovered in 2012. Comet Pan-STARRS, which listeners in this area may have heard about because it has been visible in our skies for about a month.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's been kind of a pain as far as comets are because it's been visible since about the second week of March, but it's been in a bright western sky just after sunset. So A, you needed an unobstructed view of the western horizon, and B, you had to be at the right place at the right time, because if you looked too late, the comet would set between a half an hour and an hour and a half after the sunset. So you didn't have a very big window of time to see it. And so that made it a difficult comet to pick out of evening twilight. Plus, March was a pretty cloudy and snowy month for us. So I went out probably 6 or 7 times to see the comet. I only saw it 3 times and got only a couple of images of the comet. Now, that's not to say that other folks in different parts of the world didn't get good pictures, and they did. So those are 2 comets that are both visible in the western sky.
And then there's a third one coming that everybody's excited about.
The third comet is called Comet Ison, I-S-O-N, and it reaches its closest approach to the sun on Thanksgiving Day, the 28th of November. But the special thing about Comet Ison is its distance to the sun at its closest point is only about as little less than 700,000 miles. So in that case, we call that comet a sun grazer, because it passes so close to the sun that the sun's powerful gravity could destroy the comet, or if it survives, it could make it very, very bright following its perihelion passage, its closest approach to the sun.
Wouldn't it get sucked up, melted? I mean, Mal, coming that close to the sun sounds like tricky business.
Yeah, it is. It's not. In other words, it's not heading directly to the sun. It's the orbital path that it follows. It's going to make a real fast loop around it. The way orbits work is the closer you are to the sun, the faster you will go.
So that's an advantage
all the way
for
back
this
to,
poor comet.
To Kepler, I guess, on that one. But so it's going to speed up as it goes around the sun. But it's almost the same thing we do when we send satellites, like the Voyager probes, when we sent them out to the various planets. We do what's called a gravity assist around previous planets, and it will change the trajectory of it.
Sort of a slingshot effect.
Like a slingshot. And the same thing will slingshot around and come out. It will go in one side of the sun and come out the other. But as John said, this is very close. So if it doesn't get broken apart, everybody will have their fingers crossed on Thanksgiving Day. But if it loops around successfully, it should fire it up really brilliantly. And by early December, it could, and we say could, with no guarantee, that it would even be big enough so that you can, and bright enough so it can be seen in the daytime. And that would be even better than, say, Comet Hale-Bopp we saw back in 97 or 8, was it?
Kind of inspiring for the holiday season, too.
They're calling this, calling it potentially the comet of the century.
Pretty early in
the
century.
The 21st century.
well,
we should
great.
Say the comet of the century so far.
And 2013, the year of the comet. And if you have
Absolutely.
Questions about that and you want to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. There's been a lot of news lately also about the search for possible life on Mars and planning for a human trip to the red planet. We're going to talk about that, too. And if you have questions on that or other subjects that we're talking about today with our Sky Guys, we welcome your calls, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, I have to talk to you about Mars because there's been so much going on there. And Mal, first off, a private company is planning right now a mission to Mars with a husband and wife team projected to take off in January of 2018. Not that far away, 5 years away.
Right.
Lots of questions. First of all, why not NASA? Why a private venture?
I don't know if NASA would actually get funding if they went to Congress for this and said, we want to send a husband and wife to Mars.
But they've been talking about manned missions to Mars forever, for the last 20, 30 years.
They're also trying to privatize a lot of the launches that we're having. You know, we're familiar already with SpaceX. Most people probably have heard about them. They so far have successfully sent, it's a private company that has sent supplies to the International Space Station using private funds. They use their own launch facilities. There's another company that is just testing a rocket this month that's called orbital something. I forgot their name. I had it written down somewhere.
But this is the wave of the future.
The wave of the future. So, and also we have the guy who runs Virgin Atlantic has Virgin Galactic that he's doing in conjunction out in the southwestern part of the of our state with Bert Rutan and a few other people to send a private spacecraft and charge people a couple of $100,000 for making a ride into space. So the space tourism thing is coming along. So people with money are trying to figure out what to do it. In this case, it's a guy named Dennis Tito, who in 2001 bought a seat on a Soyuz spacecraft out of Russia and became the first space tourist to visit the International Space Station. He's a multi-billionaire, and he doesn't know what to do with his money. So he says, all right, here's what we're going to do. I would like to get us to Mars. So he wants a husband and wife. There are particular parameters to do it, to send just not to land on Mars, just go to Mars, loop around it, come back to Earth over 500 days in space.
Wow.
In a spacecraft that's about the size of a bedroom. About 12 by 14 feet or something like that.
Okay, well, we could probably talk endlessly, John, about the personal dynamics between the husband and wife. You'd have to have a really, really good marriage to make it there and back. Yeah. But why not landing, John? I mean, what a bummer to go all that way and you don't even get to go down.
Well, I think one of the ploys of this mission is to create public awareness and to show people that it can be done. I won't say that it's easy to do what they're doing. This is called a fast track trajectory, where it's very low consumption of fuel, no major rocket firings, 500 some odd day, I think it's 501 round trip time. It's launched at a favorable, I think January 5th, 2018, and it comes back May 21st, 2019.
When Mars and Earth are closest, that's the optimal time to take off.
Yes. Or when they get back, they'll be closest. So the distance traveled by the spacecraft is a minimum. So landing a spacecraft and then getting it back up to orbit, docking with the ship that's going to take them home adds so much complexity and cost and risk and danger. You couldn't do it with a crew of two, and a larger crew would cost a lot more money.
All right, I got a couple more questions for both of you guys about Mars. We're taking your calls too at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. Presenting in concert, Bruce Hornsby, an intimate solo piano performance, Friday, April 19th at 8 p.m. Tickets at ccanh.com. And Nobis Engineering, an employee-owned company with a 24-year legacy of collaboration, responsiveness, and community involvement. Information at nobisengineering.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
You may not be able to tell by the weather, but it is spring, a time when we all start clearing out the clutter we've accumulated over the cold months. If you have an old car that you'd like to clear out but don't know what to do with, donate it to NHPR. We take care of everything, the paperwork, the pickup. All you have to do is sign the dotted line and accept your charitable gift receipt. Put a spring in your step with a gift to your favorite public radio station. Call 1-877-393-NHPR or visit nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the issue of campaign finance reform returns to the Granite State. Email us your questions or thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with our Sky Guys about recent missions and discoveries in the world of astronomy. What questions do you have for us, Sky Guys, about some of the issues we've been talking about? The year of the comet, that's 2013. We also talked earlier about Russia's mega asteroid that caused such a shock back in February. We've also been talking about planning for a human trip to Mars, that planning underway right now. And in just a couple minutes, we'll talk about the possibility of life on Mars and excitement over the possibility of life forms on Jupiter's moon, Europa. But Mel Cameron, one more question for you about this human trip to the red planet, which you guys described as being funded by a private company supposed to take off in January of 2018. That's the optimum time. Why a married couple, and why is everybody saying they should be middle-aged, not young'uns?
Well, basically, they want them to be past the childbearing age So that the difficulty is when you're heading out into deep space like that, you're getting hit with rays and radiation from the sun, which, of course, on Earth we're protected from. A spacecraft, if it's designed properly, can minimize some of that. But there is a danger that you may actually come back from a trip like that infertile because of all the radiation you've been exposed to. So that's part of it. They want an older couple. Somebody once they put on online somewhere, why not a really old couple? Let's, you know, forget about it. Just send them out there and send them back. They'll have a great time. The difficulty is, in my mind, choosing that couple.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, usually astronauts are, you know, a mixed group. You've got one who's, you know, good at piloting it and one who's good at spacewalks or whatever. I mean, why a married couple? Why not a guy and a gal or two guys or whatever combination seems best scientifically?
Yeah. It sounds like in a trip like this, there are certain things you'd have to be trained to do. I mean, you have to have food. You have to know how to prepare the food. You probably, on something like that, it's conceivable you may even be able to grow some food, I suppose. You know, simple, quick-growing vegetables.
They've
learned how to do.
9 months. You can grow some vegetables in 9 months.
And they want to, I think it's more of a symbolic gesture to get a couple. It has to be a heterosexual couple. And there is some controversy about that. You know, why, you know, everybody has a complaint about why did you do it this way? Why shouldn't you do it this way? And leave it open to anybody and everybody.
Well, and it's a private company again.
But it's a private company.
Kind of
it's Dennis Tito. His company is called Inspiration Mars. And he's spending $1 to $2 billion on this project.
Well, be real interesting to see who signs up for that voyage.
I've already signed up to go with my wife.
Have you really?
Yeah, no.
You, I would believe it. Well, again, if you want to join us on that subject or others, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And John Gene 40, one more quick question for you about Mars. Those wonderful rovers, Curiosity is still working away, has confirmed the presence of carbon on Mars. Now, John, is this hints of past presence of carbon or current carbon that's there right now?
Curiosity went to Mars, landed on Mars last August, and its mission was to determine if Mars ever provided a favorable habitat for life. That means are there now again we get into this carbon chauvinists that we all are because every life form on Earth is based on carbon. And there's a lot of good reasons for that. So for more than 20-some-odd years, scientists have been looking for organic carbon-based materials on Mars. But because Mars has a very thin atmosphere and no ozone layers, it has no protection from the ultraviolet radiation from the sun. So any organic molecules that might have constructed themselves or formed on the surface of Mars are quickly destroyed by these energetic electromagnetic rays from the sun.
I see. So Curiosity found evidence of past carbon. It didn't find, for lack of a better word, current carbon.
Well, carbon is carbon. And finding carbon on Mars would be revolutionary. And on the 12th of March, in the weeks before that, Curiosity drilled into a rock sample, a muddy sedimentary rock. Now, you know, sedimentary rocks on Earth form in the presence of the water. We now know that Mars was warmer and wetter. The other Opportunity and Spirit rovers proved that Mars was wetter and warmer once. Curiosity was sent to a place on Mars that from past Mars missions had a good prospects for providing a habitat for life in the past. So it drilled 6.4 centimeters into a sedimentary rock, and the drill dust from that rock contained sulfur, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and carbon.
Wow.
These are the essential elements for life that we find on Earth.
Or life as we know it. As you said earlier, we're carbon chauvinists. There could be other life forms that don't need carbon.
That's right. But from the limited readings of life that we have a sample size of one, Earth life. This is a profound discovery, and it was Curiosity's main mission was to find out if Mars provided a potential habitat for life. The answer to that question has now been labeled yes.
Which makes it all the too bad that this husband and wife team can't put their boots on the ground.
Well, I think what you'll see, if this mission actually goes, they raise the funds and it goes there and it's successful, before they get back, there'll be other missions with similar goals on the books.
Because it'll show the potential, kind of like Lewis and Clark. Once they went,
yes,
you know, on the way back, they met other missions. I mean, it just
opened the floodgates. Right. I think you'll see that.
All right. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And speaking of life in our own solar system, scientists have been looking at Jupiter's moon Europa for a long time, speculating about what's below the ice there. Mal Cameron, what makes Europa so intriguing?
Well, first of all, Europa is one of the four moons we call the Galilean moons. Back in 1610, Galileo looked out with a little telescope, saw these four little dots he thought were stars, and then realized they were moons, and that got him into a heap of trouble, but let's not go there. But in any event, you can see them through a decent telescope when you look at Jupiter. And the second nearest of those to the planet Jupiter is this moon Europa. It's a very icy moon. It's thought to be one of the smoothest objects in the solar system. And back in the Galileo space probe days in the late 90s, they did a lot of flybys of Europa and discovered that there were that it had effect under this icy surface, that there was a deep ocean of water.
Which just seems amazing, way, way out
right
there.
And the way they discovered that primarily is they found that there were ice chunks on the surface that, as they would go over, had evidently cracked and rotated in space and in place and moved around. They call it rafting. And because of rafting, that was an indication that there was at least a slush of some kind underneath that surface that would allow it to twist around. Since then, they've discovered that the evidence points to a very deep ocean that could be as deep as 60 miles. And the latest that they've been discovering is that with the Keck telescope that John will talk about, is though it confirms it, is that there's an interaction apparently between the ice and the water underneath it enough that creates a salty environment, which it would add to the possibility that there could be some sort of life underneath there. That 60-mile deep ocean on a moon that is roughly just slightly bigger than our own Earth moon can have more water there than we have on the surface of the Earth.
It's amazing to think about that. And then that it's so cold out there, and yet there is some water still in some liquid form, that it isn't all just one frozen ice ball.
So we have plans to go there and investigate it at some point down the road.
Another married couple.
Yeah, we're going to send them under Europa now, right?
Go ahead, John.
Well, Europa is a big enough moon so that it is known to be a differentiated body. That means when it formed, it was molten, and the heavy stuff sunk to the middle, to the center, and the lighter stuff accumulated afterwards.
Just like Earth.
Like Earth did and the other terrestrial planets, Mercury, Mars, and Venus. So it's big enough to have that process take place. So we have what we know mainly from Galileo, that orbited, it wasn't a spaceship that kind of flew by Jupiter like the Pioneer and Voyager spacecraft did. Flew by, took a whole bunch of pictures. Galileo stayed in the Jupiter system from 95 to 2003. So it had a chance to hang around a while and really get to know Europa, so that there's little doubt that this, and I heard a 100-mile deep ocean, which certainly makes it have a lot more water than the Earth does. And the surface of Europa is 206 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. But what keeps you were asking about what could keep water liquid so far from the sun. Jupiter's five times further from the sun than the Earth is. So it's very cold. But there's also some alleged interaction. There's some, since Europa is a differentiated body, it's possible that it still has at least a semi-molten core, or at least a warm core generating some warmth, which would, like the Earth has. But the biggest source of energy on Europa is the gravitational tug of war that exists between Jupiter, the most massive planet in the solar system, and other moons that orbit Jupiter. So it's Europa gets twisted and churned physically by the gravity of its neighboring moons Ganymede and Io, as well as from the planet Jupiter. This tidal heating can generate more than a trillion watts of power.
Wow, all that energy.
That friction.
That fighting between the other moons and the planet and so forth.
That basically contorts the planet, generates friction, and that's what keeps the water liquid. Now, if you throw the fact that it could be some kind of salt water, it lowers the freezing point of that water.
True.
So what Keck, using their OSIRIS spectrometer on the 10-meter Keck telescope in Hawaii, has found is that they've detected hydrogen peroxide on the surface of Europa. Now, Europa orbits Jupiter like our moon orbits the Earth. On the hemisphere that faces, that's the leading hemisphere of Europa, they find lots of hydrogen peroxide. And that's caused by the intense radiation that pings that side of the moon from Jupiter. It's very intense, very strong magnetic field, a lot of chemical interaction. What we don't know is how the surface interacts with the liquid water ocean.
Well, and here's a question. We've learned so much from those Mars rovers. I mean, Mal, is anybody exploring the possibility of sending a rover, never mind all the flybys and space probes, but actually putting some sort of equipment on the ice there?
Not so much a rover, but I mean, this is way down the road. And initially, what they want to do is send a probe that will orbit Europa. And that's going to be a challenge in itself because, remember, Europa is also orbiting Jupiter.
And
so
the probe might get sucked up in Jupiter.
Right, so you have to approach it very carefully. So you don't slam into Jupiter by mistake.
Right.
But initially what they want to do is map Europa through radar and so on and find out where is the thinnest ice possible. And then even extend that challenge to try to get something in the way of a drill that can land at that thin ice area and drill down through the ice to find where the water is.
So you actually have a hard sample.
Exactly.
A real sample. Well, right. Lots more probably waiting to be uncovered there. And John, I do have to quickly ask you, whenever we get together, we talk about the extrasolar planet count. These are planets discovered beyond our own solar system, orbiting distant stars. A lot of excitement recently about the discovery of a new extrasolar planet orbiting one of our closest stars, Alpha Centauri B. What did they find there?
Well, scientists have found, a Swiss team of astronomers has found that the star closest to the sun, only 4.3 light years away, actually 4.4 light years away, 25 trillion miles if you'd rather use miles. But there's a lot more miles. Let's stick with light years. It's only 4.3. They've found the Alpha Centauri system is a triple star system. There are two stars very similar to the sun that are orbiting close together, and then a very small cool stars orbiting that pair. Around the smaller of the two yellow stars, they've discovered a planet that is only 1.1 1/8 times the mass of the Earth.
So similar in size.
Similar in size, though don't make any vacation plans because...
Well, 25 trillion miles is a long way.
It is. Alpha Centauri B, which is the name of the planet, it has an orbital period around its star of only 3.24 days, which means its length of its year is only very, very short. When you consider that Mercury, the closest planet to the sun, orbits the sun in 88 days, this small planet orbits very quickly, and its So it has a very, very high surface temperature, so much higher than any life we understand could survive.
Here's a question, though, for you, John. I mean, it seems like this would be one of the first ones to be discovered, extrasolar planets, I mean, since it's relatively close. But you and I have talked about other extrasolar planets that were discovered much, much farther away. So it seems like this one was hiding in plain sight.
That's a very, very good question. People have been studying Alpha Centauri for planets for many years. The problem is this is a very small planet. And the way most of the extrasolar planets have been discovered so far is looking at the small gravity tug that the planet exerts on its parent star. Being only one and an eighth times more massive than the Earth, it's got a very, very minimal tug. It tugs only, it changes the speed of the star by only a half meter per second. That's the pace of someone walking.
So it's pretty amazing.
So it's a very low signal.
Found this. Right. And super quick to you, Mal Cameron. As I understand, we're going to be treated to a meteor shower coming up. Lyrid meteor showers.
Yes. The Lyrid meteor shower comes, the best time to see it is the morning of the 22nd
of April.
Yeah. And I would suggest getting up about 4 o'clock in the morning to do it, because prior to that time, you're going to have to contend a little bit with a bright gibbous moon. But you could see 10 to 20 or so meteors, but every now and then it surprises us and suddenly flashes out at about 100 an hour. So you don't know how many you're going to see. But that's the best time, the morning of the 22nd.
And Mal has guaranteed clear weather for that.
Only in my hometown.
Gentlemen, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers, Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, the return of campaign finance reform. After an election that saw unprecedented amounts of money spent, the call for limits has come up again, whether on dollar amounts or more disclosures so voters will know who's funding what. But these efforts, including one recently in New Hampshire, often bump into a variety of concerns. We'll look at the state of campaign finance in the Granite State. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next.